Life on Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Book 4, Chapter 16, The Women Who Followed. It is possible, but by no means certain, that the penitent woman with flowing hair was none other than Mary Magdalene. We do know that when Jesus continued his journey after this incident in Simon's house, we read that Mary Magdalene was with him, ministering to his needs. It is also not without significance that she is described as the woman from whom Jesus cast seven devils. It is not profitable to linger too long on this identity, but if Mary of Magdala was indeed the woman who prostrated herself in the Pharisee's house, we can understand the sublime devotion with which she followed her Lord. Love possessed her more completely than the seven demons had ever done. Who can watch her without deep emotion as she clings to him by night and day, following with weary but persistent steps as he strides out over tough mountain and rocky valley? When the inevitable storm breaks over him and the thunder rolls across the sky, we see her horrified face illuminated for an instant in the lightning flash, and she is clinging more closely still. At last she can follow him no further. She stands near the foot of the cross, her haggard eyes still seeking her dying Lord. Even his death could not separate her from him. With unfailing loyalty, she followed behind those who carried him to his tomb. While bewildered disciples mourned their weakness, she watched where he was laid. On the first day of the week, she faced an empty grave. Her cry of despair tugs at every heartstring. "They have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him." But when she thought he was furthest away, he was nearest to her. And at last she learned the greatest lesson of her life. He taught her that although her physical eyes may not behold him, although her clasping fingers could not touch him, although she might not hear the rich accents she loved so well, he was with her always to the end of the world and beyond. Great as was the work of Jesus in easing men's physical load, healing their sickness, restoring their sight, the life of Mary Magdalene shows that it was not so great as his unseen work in the heart of man. No miracle can be more wonderful to the discerning mind than the picture of the woman lost in the lowest degradation of sin, transformed into a saint glowing with love too deep to express. It is both a comfort and an incentive to realize that while the hand of the Redeemer is no longer lifted in gentle ministration to take away our physical infirmities, his greater work goes on. No abyss of sin and despair is too deep or too dark for him to reach. No heart too cold to warm into devoted love and service. There were many other women who followed him in Galilee, ministering to him of their substance. Susanna is mentioned by name. There was also Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward. This woman may have been the wife of the Capernaum court official whose son Jesus had healed by a word spoken at Cana. If that is so, it was a beautiful way of showing her gratitude, and one which must commend itself to her sisters for all time. Although their Lord is no longer in their midst, it is still possible for them to follow him and minister him of their substance in conscious response to his blessings. He is yet to show the lovely significance of a cup of cold water and the precious secret of his identity hidden in the lonely, the suffering, and the needy. It is a blessed truth that the Master still makes it possible for devoted women to follow him beside the gleaming lake and on the solitary road which leads to Jerusalem, and leading many to his feet. When Jesus reached Capernaum from his long journey through the cities and villages of Galilee, the people brought to him one possessed who was also blind and dumb. The afflicted man was restored, and those who witnessed the miracle were amazed and said, "Is not this the son of David?" Such incidents happened daily at this period of Christ's ministry. But Mark adds a fact which is probably the reason for its prominence. He tells us that scribes who had come down from Jerusalem intervened to challenge Christ. It would seem that the popularity of Jesus was becoming so disturbing, particularly after the resurrection at Nain, that a deputation was sent quickly from Jerusalem to use its considerable power in an effort to check it. These scribes lost no time in launching their campaign against him. Their attack was more subtle than maybe at first apparent. They could not deny that Christ was performing miracles, but they could question the source of his power. Miraculous powers and the ability to expel unclean spirits were commonly claimed among the Jews at that time, and such activities were countenanced by the scribes and Pharisees. Their point of attack was not, therefore, on whether Christ performed miracles, but by what power he worked. "This fellow," said they, "doth not cast out devils, but by Beelzebub, the prince of the devils." How quickly and decisively Jesus confounded them. What paltry figures they made, confronted by his truth and purity. If their allegation was true, then the kingdom of Beelzebub must be in considerable confusion. It was obviously doomed to fall in its state of civil war. How can it be otherwise if, in the name of Beelzebub, he is freeing men from the domination of Beelzebub? To add to their perplexity, Jesus went further. "Your disciples cast out devils too. In whose name do they cast them out?" Obviously their power could not be from the same source, or they would be bound in honour to believe in him. "Let them be your judges." Having reduced their challenge to absurdity with irresistible logic, Jesus brought home to them the only alternative. "But if I cast out devils by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God is come unto you." He went even further. In coming to bring the kingdom of God, Jesus had come to engage in mortal combat with the devil and his works. Sin in all its ramifications had to be stamped out. He would achieve it finally when his hour had come. His work with those who were afflicted with the terrible effects of sin was an earnest of that coming victory. He was entering into the strong man's house and spoiling his goods. To do that, he needed the power of God to bind the strong man. He required also the faith of those he released. Otherwise his work for them could only fail. "He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad." But Jesus had not yet finished with these men. He had shattered their attack. Now he turned from his own defence to denounce them. It was brief, but it was terrible. Every one of them must have gone cold with fear as he convicted them. Without answering him a word, they went their way. There is something far worse than a lack of faith, which is, after all, only passive opposition to the working of the Spirit of God. Jesus was faced with an active, organized opposition, which for selfish reasons sought to work on the side of the enemy Christ had come to destroy. It not only denied him the Spirit of God, but attributed his power to Satan. That was something which could never be forgiven. Blasphemy against the Son, evil as that was, could be repented of. But to speak against God by denouncing his Spirit as evil was to be guilty of eternal sin and to be forever unpardoned. This dreadful indictment the scribes brought upon themselves because, says Mark, they said he had an unclean spirit. It was on this occasion that Christ's mother and brethren came to Capernaum and asked for him. His attitude to them suggests that their mission sought in some way to impede his ministry. Whether it was that Mary had heard of the concerted efforts which were being made against him and, moved by fear and affection, was anxious to persuade him against continuing his work, we do not know. But it seems certain from his apparent refusal to see her that the maternal instinct was pressing strongly still, in spite of two rebukes which had already wounded her sensitive spirit. We find it hard to criticize a mother's protective and possessive instinct. The sword must pierce her soul once more. Jesus does not condemn his mother, but he is still about his Father's business. His whole life is dedicated to founding a spiritual relationship far exceeding the bounds of earthly ties. He can no longer acknowledge their authority. It is for them to acknowledge his. It is unhappily significant that they waited outside, desiring him to come to them. It could never be so. They could go to him. He could never come to them. Behold my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and mother. Chapter 17, Teaching in Parables. Leaving the city with its scheming scribes, its crowds, and its delicate demands of loyalty, Jesus moved away towards the seashore. Reading the 13th chapter of Matthew, we can almost sense the freedom of spirit which liberated him as he reached the water's edge and met the fresh breezes, fragrant with the scent of summer and the tang of the sea. Stepping into a boat, he would ask the disciples to push out a little from the shore, so that he could command the vast audience which was assembling in the natural rising amphitheatre of the bay. We like to picture the scene as Jesus began to teach. It was probably nearing midsummer. The warm sun was bathing everything in its golden light. The blue sky, made deeper by the silvery spinnakers of cloud, threw its deepness on the breeze-stirred water. The waves collapsed on the shingle in short, flat crashes. Beyond the stirring multitudes, the hills curved upwards to meet the overhanging sky, their slopes a radiant tapestry of flower and herb and rich brown earth. And when the crowds had settled and become expectantly silent, Jesus opened his mouth to teach. His mind caught and held the spirit of the moment, and he lent eternity to the distant wheat fields shining a premature gold in the sun, and to the humble activities which were visible from his gently swaying pulpit. It is interesting to notice that from this time Jesus used parables with a new emphasis. The method was quite familiar to the Jews, who were instructed by the rabbis in this way. But even cursory comparison shows that in this, as in his direct approach, he spoke with authority and not as the scribes. Apart from the fundamental difference of motive, what had the rabbis to offer which could compare with the pictures drawn by such a loving student of sea and sky, who watched successive seasons bring to birth changing colour, growth and song, who knew the ways of men in all the shadowed and sunlit paths of their human life, who wove into these things he knew and loved so well the heavenly truths he had received from his Father? The parables which Jesus spoke had been well described as the outline shadows, large perhaps and dim, as the light of heavenly things falls on well-known scenes, which correspond to and have their counterpart in spiritual realities. Difficulty may be experienced concerning the explanation which Jesus gave to his disciples regarding his use of parables. It is Mark who records Christ's answer in the most unequivocal words, "Unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. But unto them that are without, all these things are done in parables, that seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest at any time they should be converted and their sins should be forgiven them." These words have caused many to wonder whether Jesus used parables deliberately to conceal truth which could have saved his hearers. It is important to notice that this inability to see and understand is confined by the Lord to them that are without. Nor must it be forgotten that but for a brief hour ago, Jesus had been in conflict with scribes from Jerusalem, whom he had condemned as being guilty of an unforgivable sin. Those scribes had growing numbers of their supporters in Galilee. The crowd which had assembled round the shore that day was sharply divided between those who were his disciples or were sympathetic hearers, and those who were his implacable enemies. His parables would have a very different effect on these two classes. Those who desired to be scribes instructed in the kingdom of heaven would receive them thoughtfully, and if they found anything too difficult, they would seek him out with the request, "Declare unto us this parable." Thus they would gradually learn, in a way they could never forget, the mysteries of the kingdom. But in the heart of his enemies there would be no such desire. But their careful attention was due to an anxiety to take hold of some word upon which they could condemn him. They saw and they heard, but their failure to perceive and understand was the result of their deliberate blindness and hardness of heart. Jesus seems to confirm this in his further word of explanation. "For whosoever hath, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance. But whosoever hath not, from him shall be taken away even that he hath." It is outside our purpose to deal in detail with the parables which Jesus spoke on this occasion. But we cannot pass them without noticing both their general import and the wonderful harmony which exists between them. Four of them were spoken from the boat, three were given to the disciples when Jesus had sent the people away and returned to his house. All seven of the parables recorded in the 13th chapter of Matthew are parables of the kingdom. They were a vindication of the words uttered to the scribes earlier that day, "If I cast out devils by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God is come unto you." They were also a justification of his welcome into intimate relationship of those who believed on him in answer to the human claims of his mother and his brethren. This series of parables has to do with the beginnings of the kingdom of God under the limitations imposed by the present era of sin and mortality. Later on, as his ministry drew to its climax, his parables dealt with the full and final aspect of the kingdom, when the king shall return from his father's side, demand the retribution of evildoers, and bring blessings of faithfulness to those who have served him well. It was impossible to convey clearly all the aspects, even of the first stages of the kingdom, in one parable. In his wisdom, Jesus told the story in a succession of pictures, each supplementing the other. The first two long parables, the sower and the wheat and the tares, describe successively the birth and the progress of the preparation for the kingdom of God. The two shorter ones, the mustard seed and the leaven, show how the individual seed develops until the harvest. In the parable of the sower, we see the husbandman throwing the seed over the whole field, irrespective of its condition. That seed only grows strongly in places. It is not the fault of the husbandman, nor of the seed, but of the land that receives it. No seeds flourished on the hardened paths, the stony places, or amid the thorns. But in the deep, well-ploughed ground it grew abundantly. The parable of the wheat and the tares takes up the story of the kingdom. Jesus takes away from us the picture of the whole field and brings into focus the good soil where the seed is established. The seed is no longer the word. It has become the children of the kingdom. The world outside is ignored. We see only the kingdom of God in its embryo form. Among the growing wheat, all is not well. There are seeds growing strongly that have their origin not from the sower, but from the earth. They have sprung up, threatening to check the vigour of the corn. But the wise husbandman allows this persecution and suffering. To remove the opposition would be to weaken the roots of the corn. The harvest is coming, and then the purging will take place, and the fully developed wheat will be gathered into barns. These two parables do little to indicate the full extent and glory of the kingdom of God. Indeed, they rather emphasize the limited nature of the sower's effort, and the struggle for the survival of the seed, even in the rich, responsive soil. But in the parable of the mustard seed which follows, Jesus shows that this small and difficult beginning will end in something which is infinitely greater. In the parable of the leaven, he teaches that the little leaven, all but unnoticed in the three measures of meal, will eventually permeate the whole matter into which it was introduced. These two parables do not describe the gradual growth of the kingdom, either in the hearts of men or in the church, but they form a perfect complement to the parables of the sower and the tares, for they show the end of the Lord. A Galilean carpenter surrounded by a few unlettered countrymen, first discredited and then ignominiously crucified by the leaders of his country, it is hard to imagine a smaller or less significant beginning. Yet the final result will be seen in the day when every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. The three parables which Jesus spoke later in the house were intended only for those who symbolized the corn, which was already beginning to sprout up in the good ground. The hearts, which were even now changing under the beneficent influence of the Son of God. To them Jesus showed the transcendent value of the find they had made. It was like treasure found in a field, like a pearl of fabulous price, something which men would gladly surrender all they had to acquire. In the parable of the dragnet, he warned them not to esteem their treasure lightly. When the gospel net was full, there would be a separation among the children of the kingdom, and only the righteous would survive the divine judgment. So within the scope of a few short parables, Jesus gave a complete picture of the impact of his coming and his gospel both upon the world and upon the believer. The rejection of the former would lead to destruction, but the faithfulness of the latter would bring indescribable blessing in the day when the righteous shall shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father.